the whole Jewish community in the United States and the evangelicals would all rise up in rebellion in the U.S., even if the United States pressured Israel in terms of Gaza. So in other words, Biden wants to get reelected. Members of Congress want to get reelected. That's the name of the game. And all this other stuff feeds into it. So all this bullshit about, some kind of an analysis, you can't have a real, because a real analysis and the real use of terms of international law like genocide and apartheid absolutely contradict what your real purpose is and your real interests, which is asserting your hegemony over the whole area of normalizing. So you can't really deal with the issues because you don't want to expend the political capital domestically. And at the same time, you just want to quietize the Palestinian issue to a point where you can get on with the bigger issue at stake geopolitically, which is normalization. So in other words, they're talking past each other. They're sort of talking about the Palestinian issue, but really the Palestinian issue means nothing. It's just a nuisance that you've got to somehow deal but not resolve. Because resolving it would really cost you too much political capital.
What's your assessment of what Hamas did on October 7th? Was there any degree of justice in what they did? Was this just a brutal, criminal, ISIS-like terrorist assault, or was it a resistance, an act of resistance?
No, I think it was an act of resistance. What settler colonialism always does everywhere is it criminalizes resistance. So, the terrorists are always the non-state actors. They're never this, even though you can see here, Israel's killed, if you include people lying under the rubble, Israel's killed more than 40,000 Palestinians. That's not terror. In other words, there's no such thing as state terror because states somehow they claim the legitimacy to use armed force. So that's legitimate. Whereas resistance to colonization is not legitimate because you're going against the state. These are non-state actors. So non-state actors don't have rights to resist. International law accepts the right of armed struggle. Within international law, which means you can't attack civilians. That's hard to implement because states attack civilians all the time. Can you really ask a non-state actor who is really struggling to just exist and to continue existing in the face of oppression by a much stronger state with a state army, to that the non-state actor, the weak actor, has to be in compliance with international law, and the state that's oppressing it doesn't. So it's something built in. So article of Hamas, I mean, first of all, I don't accept their program whatsoever, but I understand that they're a resistance movement. The fact that innocence, was a terrible thing, and there was a lot of violence, and there was sexual violence. You can never justify that. You can explain it, but you can't. I condemn, the violence isn't the right word either because it's too broad a word, but the killing of innocent. Said that, terrorism has always been a part of warfare. And states have used terrorism much more than non-state actors, actually. There's a guy named Rommel, R-U-M-M-E-L, who has a website. He died a few years ago, but he has a book called Death by Government. And he says, in the course of the 20th century, the whole 20th century, about 170,000 innocent people have been killed by what we call terrorists, by non-state actors, okay? Which is a lot of people, 170,000 innocent people over the whole 20th century. But he says, over the course of the whole 20th century, 112 million innocent civilians have been killed by states. And in his book, But Death by Government, he describes exactly what he means. So states are much more culpable in terrorism than non-state actors are. They use terrorism. Certainly Israel used terrorism. Begin, Shamir, were proud of the fact that their terrorist acts like blowing up the King David Hotel or blowing up markets or buses succeeded in driving the British out and intimidating the Arabs. I mean, the Jewish militias used it all the time. Terrorism works. The United States and Israel and the Arab countries, Western Arab countries, were on the cusp of normalization. 2 weeks before October 7th, Netanyahu was in the UN holding up a map of the greater Israel, including the occupied territories. This is the map of Israel, and saying we are within a week or so of signing a normalization agreement with Saudi Arabia to be the new Middle East. And the price of that, of course, the Palestinians would have been erased as a political force. They would have been erased as an issue. And once you have normalization in Israel and the Arab world, Palestinians disappear. And that, I think, explains a lot about the timing of October 7th. This was an attack. I don't think it went the way Hamas thought. I think they were surprised that they got through. They were surprised there was no army. There were a lot of non-Hamas people that came in with them and did a lot of the killing. I mean, it was a very chaotic and messy thing. Yes, that attack stopped the normalization process. It didn't happen, and I don't know if it will happen, because even though Saudi Arabia still wants to normalize with Israel, even Saudi Arabia has a street. It has public opinion. And the whole Arab world has been inflamed against Israel. And not only that, the whole world. Millions of people are coming out in Europe and Asia and Latin, all over the world, in support of Palestinians. So say what you will, that attack on October 7th politically stopped this normalization process. It stopped Israel from implementing completely, with American support, its apartheid system of nailing it down. And it's reopened. I mean, now I don't see how the international community is going to move ahead in the Middle East in any way without the Palestinians. All this stuff was done without the Palestinians. They were never really an actor. Now they're an actor. And that's because of October 7th.
So is this a turning point in Israeli and Palestinian history? And if it is, how is Israeli responding to what happened on October 7th? And how do you see Israeli society evolving and moving forward? I mean, there are Israeli flags everywhere.
That's right.
I mean, there are often, whenever I come here, there are Israeli flags flying everywhere. Right. But there are now. And there are all these protests. Before October 7th, there were all these massive protests against the government trying to change the judiciary.
Yeah, that's right.
They've pivoted, and now they're demanding that the hostages, Netanyahu, do what's required to release the hostages.
No, but you still have now. Those demonstrations are still anti. They still want Netanyahu to resign.
Do you see Israeli society evolving in a positive or constructive way, or a inwardly observant area becoming more self-conscious in a constructive way?
No, self-conscious is not a strong Israeli trait, being reflective. And you can't, in a way, because if you're old in a settler colonial, we use the word settler colonialism. Sometimes we don't use it in a way that we understand it. We use it as kind of a accusation. But settler colonialism, nothing. And it means that you're in a constant war with the colonized. The Palestinians can never, ever accept the loss of their country, the loss of their land, the loss of their livelihoods, the loss of their freedom, the loss of their identities, and simply normalize that. They always have to resist. It's built in. And for Israelis then, not only do you have the insecurity, but Israelis can't admit what they did. They can't. So everything starts on October 7th. When Guterres, Secretary General of the UN, said this attack on October 7th happened in a context of 16 years of siege or occupation, everything, he was really attacked by Israel, because that's a can of worms. If Israelis do go back and do an account or reflect on what's, they have destroyed the Palestinian people. They have engaged in genocide. They have stolen the Palestinians' land. They continue to oppress them. So we can't open all that stuff up, because it means the end of the whole Zionist enterprise. It means we have to admit that we were the oppressors. We have to stop the oppression, but the whole system is based on oppression. You can't possibly get Israel going without continued settlement, not only in the West Bank, but settlement inside Israel too, like I said, that's still going on, and demolishing homes. It's an ongoing process all the time. It never ends. Settler colonialism wants to normalize. That's the end for settler colonialism. But the Palestinians are strong enough, actually, unlike, let's say, the Native Americans in the U.S. or the First Nations in Canada, that were smaller populations and marginalized, so that the settler colonial project, like in Canada, could succeed normal. There's a normal Canada that's, in a way, accepted by the First Nations, because they're simply too marginal and too powerless to try to assert some national. So they want control of their lands a little bit. They want control of their cultures. They want, recognition as First Nations. But they don't seek the overthrow of the Canadian government and a new, it's not a national movement like that. The Palestinians are. They're half the population. They're the majority if you bring refugees back. They have national aspirations. They want to end Israel. They want a Palestinian state so that.
And now you just said they're half the population. Now some people may be choking and saying, wait a minute, the Arab Palestinians are only 20% of the population.
No, I mean of the whole of all the whole country. That is, there's one state today. That's what people have to understand. There is no more occupation. You know, after 56 years of Israeli rule over the West Bank and Gaza, the settlement of 750,000 settlers, the building of roads and infrastructure, the incorporation of the occupied territory, the West Bank in particular, into Israel proper, you can't talk about occupation, which is a temporary military situation. It's permanent. Israel's made it so that there is one state between the river and the sea. There's one governing authority. There's one law system, there's military law as well, but it's, the Israeli legal system is over the entire country, physically, militarily, economically. There's only one state today.
And the minute you cross over the King Hussein, the Allenby Bridge from Jordan, over the Jordan River into the Jordan Valley, you're in Israel. It is as Israeli as Haifa and Tel Aviv.
On the contrary, the Jordan Valley's been cleared of Palestinians. It's almost all Israelis, except for the little enclave of Jericho.
Okay, so half the
country. So the point I'm trying to make is, if you already have a state, but you cannot give citizenship to half the population, because they're not Jewish. It has to be a Jewish state. But you also can't allow that half the population to remain on their lands, because you want their lands for the land of Israel. And apartheid is the only way out for a settler country. Like, take the Palestinians that you can't get rid of. You try to get rid of as many as you can, making them refugees or killing them or whatever, like in Gaza. But in the end, they're staying population. So you have to confine them to Bantustans. It's the same thing as South Africa. Now, apartheid, I think, is not sustainable. People, the people that are being imprisoned can't accept that system. They're going to continue to resist, whether it's in terrorism, so-called, or armed resistance, armed struggle, or politically, like the ANC. I mean, they had an armed wing, but they also had a very strong political wing. Same with the FLN in Algeria. So, in other words, Israel, there's no way that Israel can normalize the situation. So what Israelis have to do is frame it as if we're the victims, we're the peaceful country, they're terrorists. You have to criminalize, and you can't open a discussion that it all legitimizes the Palestinians as a party in this, because the minute you do that, you're calling into question your own legitimacy.
How do you see that conversation opening up? How do you see this being resolved? I mean, this is the big question. If the international community, of course, what's that? The United States, I can't conceive of the United States ever demanding that Israel either become a single democratic state or that the two-state solution become something more than just a vision. And that there be a pathway there, but God forbid they should force it to happen. And, the UK, Germany, the Western powers, I can't making this happen. What do you see to be the the end of the tunnel and all that?
Well, the whole idea of two states, first of all, we have to dismiss. I mean, it's childish. And they know it. I mean, I can't believe Blinken and Biden don't know the two states. There's no two-state solution. I mean, you know, you're not going to dismantle these huge settlement cities or the infrastructure of highways or Israeli military or whatever. So that means then that, you know, I'm in favor of one democratic state. I'm a member of the one of the founders of the one democratic state campaign. Now, it's like South Africa, I think. In South Africa as well, the whites were not going to be party to dismantling the apartheid system. Why would they? The benefit economically, and they have South Africa, they had 89% of the land, and the Bantustans, where the black African population was confined, the huge majority was 11% of the land. You know, why would they dismantle that? And their conception, their term for the end of apartheid was a bloodbath. That was what they all believed happened at the end of apartheid. So the ANC didn't bother to talk to the white population. They did in a sense, and in a very important sense. Let me backtrack a bit on that. And that is that in 1950, in the Freedom Charter, the ANC said, we are all South Africans. The end of apartheid is against the apartheid system. This isn't against white people. White people will stay in this country. They'll be equal citizens. This is going to be one. We're all South, you know, we heard Mandela say that 100 times. We're all South Africans. But still, that didn't convince the white South Africans, of course. There were some whites that were important in the ANC as activists, but the vast majority, you know, didn't want the system to collapse. So what the ANC had to do then was to bypass them. Said, all right, the hell with you guys. We're not going to waste our time trying to convince you. We're not going to, because you have an interest in this system continuing. And they went to the international community, not the governments that were also against them, like governments are against the Palestinians. They went to the people, to us. And you and I, people of our age, were all engaged in the anti-apartheid struggle.
So pivots to Palestine.
So what I'm saying is, it doesn't matter what Israelis think. I'm not going to at all be a party to a peacemaking process in which the state of Israel and the apartheid system is dismantled. They're not going to do that, and why would they do that? So we have to bypass them, like in South Africa, and we don't have the governments on our side. It's very close to the South African case in terms of its structure and strategies, and we have to go. I think the Palestinian issue has reached the level of support internationally, if you look what's happening, that the anti-apartheid struggle had.
But so, there's no Palestinian leadership.
Now we get to the big difference. The big difference is there was an ANC. And there used to be a PLO, and Arafat dismantled the PLO because he wanted to be the president of the Palestinian Authority, and Abu Mazen has continued that. So that's a huge issue for the Palestinians. And there are Palestinians. There's a movement to try to either revive the PLO or create something new. But that's true. There is no vehicle. That's a huge difference.
And there's no national liberation movement, Palestinian.
Well, there's no vehicle for that. I mean, there could be.
I mean,
but
there's lots of grassroots Palestinian resistance.
That's right. That's right.
But there's no organized
because
Palestinian
you don't have,
national liberation
because
movement.
You don't have PLO. That's one thing. A second difference is, all right, there's three. The second difference is that even though South Africa imprisoned the African leadership, like Mandela was 28 years in prison, and killed some, and some were in exile, nevertheless, there was a black African leadership could exist, and there was a leadership. Here you have a situation where every single potential Palestinian leader from the age of 12 is identified. And this is true back in 1948. Israel had what were called the village list. They were killing, because people are saying, where's the Palestinian leadership? I'm saying they were killing every potential, not even actual, Palestinian leader back in 1948. So every single Mandela that exists today is either dead or in prison. They're not out in the street. That's the second. And the third difference, which is really important, is that the ANC always had an end game. One person, one vote. So when we were boycotting South Africa, or we were demanding the end of apartheid, and people would say, well, what's after apartheid? We would all say one person, one vote, and whites were a part of that. And that's what allowed the transition in the end. That's what allowed us to end apartheid, because we all knew why we were boycotting, what the plan was, and then the plan was executed. The ANC developed the constitution before the end of apartheid. The institutions were in place and so on.
But there's no end game.
The Palestinians have no end game. Not only no vehicle, not only no leadership, but they have no end game. You know, if you ask Abu Mazen, he'll say two states. You know, some people talk about one state. Even the one state that we're working on hasn't really caught on in an active political way. Most Palestinians are just trying to survive. They're just trying to deal, or they're protesting or whatever. And that's the fatal flaw. And it's very hard. I'm cutting them all the slack. This isn't criticism. Because they've been dispersed on purpose, because there's no PLO hub to hold all the fragments of the Palestinian community together, and they're not in contact with each other, and the Palestinians in Syria are in terrible shape, and they're not in touch with the Palestinians in Lebanon that are in terrible shape, and they're not in touch with the refugees in Jordan, who aren't in touch with the West Bank, who aren't in touch with Russia, with Gaza, who aren't in touch with Israel, who aren't in touch. You have all these Palestinian communities in a centripetal way, you know, going off without a PLO to hold them together, a center, and each own survival issues to deal with. So they have different agendas. And so it's very hard to get the Palestinian people without the leadership, without a program, without a PLO, enough behind a political program that they could do what the ANC did. They have the international support, but what they're lacking is that organization and leadership and program that the ANC had. And that's a little bit what our group, the One Democratic State Campaign, is trying to do, at least to insert the political program to generate that discussion.
So let me ask you, Jeff Halper, to wrap this up, and thank you so much for your time. It's now been, 51 years since you arrived in Israel, kind of a very altruistic and open-hearted and imaginative and hopeful American activist.
But politically active.
And politically active.
Right.
Where do your hopes and expectations lie now? Like, where are you now?
Right.
Where is your head now?
Right.
Are you do you despair of the whole situation?
No.
Or do
no.
you see a light at the end of the tunnel?
No. Yeah. First of all, they don't have the luxury of despair. I mean, how can I despair? I'm living the good life, and you know, the Palestinians. If anybody's going to despair, it's them. It's not me. But I don't believe in hope either, because hope is a kind of religious concept that you know, people are losing hope that they might win. Corporations don't hope that they can run the world. They work at it, and they have strategies, and they. So I believe in struggle. You have to understand that here I'm taking a leaf out of Miles Horton, who was a very important fighter for civil rights and for labor rights in the American South in the 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s. And he always said, Miles Horton said, you know, if you take a really significant chunk of social justice as your mission, you know, like dealing with the Israeli-Palestinian issue, you know that you might not, like Martin Luther King said, you might not see the mountain, you know, by the end of your lifetime. It's not like, that's where burnout comes in, where activists think, all right, I'm gonna come in and we're going to, in a year this will be, and then they burn out. If you're in a struggle for the long haul, it's the long haul. That's his concept. And maybe you can get to the resolution, but at least you're chipping away and you know that you're being effective. You know you have a strategy, you know you have an organization that we don't have, but that's what we're trying to. And you know that you're chipping away at it. It might be the next generation or two that are going to fulfill it, but that's what sustains you. The fact that you're in a struggle and you're doing what has to be done. And so I think that's what prevents despair. And that's why you don't need hope. As long as you're being effective and strategic, you know, you can win. And I mean, I believe we can win.
And you also realize it's the only thing you could be doing maybe you can improve at the margins or come up with a slightly new tactic.
That's right.
But you're only doing what you can only do.
That's right. That's right. Well, that's the reformist idea, you know, the fact that, you know, I can, some humanitarian aid, if I came to Palestinian families and I said, you know, I'll give you some, a little bit of money so you can survive the your demolition for 6 months or something, you know, that's nice to do, but it doesn't change things. If you want to change things, you have to be involved in political struggle, and I think that's what sustains me and other activists. But if you're lacking that political understanding, you know, if you do look at it in kind of a liberal way, that's the problem with the liberals, or in a way that I think isn't constructive, then you do get into despair because nothing changes. So it's not that you know, we can always lose a political struggle, but at least you know the struggle, and you're doing what has to be done from a really good analysis of how to attack the oppressors. Then I think you know, that sustains you because you're really engaged in meaningful political work.
Thank you, Jeff Halper.
Thank you, David Kettenberg.
Jeff Halper is a founding member of ICAD, the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. He's also the author of a host of books, including An Israeli in Palestine, War Against the People, and Decolonizing Israel, Liberating Palestine, Zionism, Settler Colonialism, and the Case for a One Democratic State. Learn more about Jeff Halper, ICAD, and listen to our conversation at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's special edition of the GPM, a listener-supported podcast, coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions, in Palestine. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, Canada's Harbinger Media Network. Wherever or however you're listening, reading, or watching, please help us make the GPM happen. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. By the way, the guy behind this guitar is Dan Weisenberger. Thanks for your fabulous instrumental themes, Dan. I'm David Kattenberg, over and out for now.
Broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain, British Columbia.